Hello, everyone, and welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. I'm Paul Taylor, the president of Evolving Wisdom, one of the organizations producing this event, and tonight we will be continuing this remarkable international conversation about the future of spiritual practice with Sensei Diane Musho Hamilton. Terry Patton, the visionary behind this groundbreaking series, is also our host. Terry is a vital leading voice in the fields of integral evolutionary practice, leadership, and spirituality. He is the author with Ken Wilber of Integral Life Practice, and his personal website is integralspiritualpractice.com. Welcome, Terry.
Thank you so much, Paul. Hi, everybody. Thanks for tuning in and for continuing to participate so actively and passionately in this conversation. I created this with the intention, sincerely, that we have a conversation that actually advances the leading edge of consciousness and culture's evolution by deepening a dialogue on how our spirituality can evolve itself in a way to help us rise to the challenges of our time and create a cultural context for a transition to a sustainable human presence on our planet. We've been exploring a whole series of enlivening conversations that have catalyzed me and I know many of you. And tonight I'm honored to be joined in conversation by Sensei Diane Musho Hamilton in a dialogue we decided to title Dancing with the Collective Field of Light and Shadow. Diane is a gifted facilitator, a mediator, and a spiritual teacher living in Utah and traveling the world. She's well known as an innovator in facilitating group dialogues, and especially her capacity to really fearlessly engage controversial and often difficult conversations about culture, religion, race, gender relations, politics. Diane is a fully ordained Zen priest and teacher. She studied Buddhism since 1984 and was given Dharma Transmission, Shiho, by her Zen master Genpo Roshi in 2006. I had the pleasure of being present. Diane is an old friend and teaching partner and colleague. We worked together with Ken Wilber and a core team at Integral Institute in Denver, Colorado, starting in 2004, working with the creation of Integral Life Practice and the early days of evolving a clear approach to integral spirituality. Her specialty and what she's most known for is the working with the big mind process, which is a facilitation technique that Genpo Roshi synthesized to convey Eastern teachings to Western audiences in an experiential way. And these days, she does much of her teaching as a founder and core faculty member of iEvolve, the Gold Global Practice Community. She lives in Salt Lake City with Mike Zimmerman, her husband, a wonderful guy, but also a lawyer and also a sensei. And they have four grown children and one dog. Welcome, Diane.
Well, on a
let's not leave Ollie out of this.
No, Liz, I was just going to say on a down day there were maybe three or four dogs in the home. But hey, Terry, it's great to be here, and it's really lovely to be with your really engaged audience and this wonderful number of people who are engaging this conversation and the miracle of virtual reality. So I'm really looking forward to this, and thank you for having me.
Oh, absolutely. It's a delight and an honor. Well, as I mentioned to you when we were chatting the other day, I've seen a number of really important threads emerge in this evolving conversation that I thought would be especially rich for us to engage. You know, the frame has to do with our social responsibility, and I do want to visit that, but I thought it might be interesting to begin with a theme that emerged just over the last month or so, which has to do with how in transparent communication we stay radically present and curious and in touch with one another and the field that holds us in a very available way, surrendering the immunity that comes from reciting opinions we've already formed or speaking speaking words we've already created. This emerged especially powerfully when I was dialoguing with Thomas Hubel when I was in Germany a couple of weeks ago. And the feeling that we were, one of the ideas we were getting into as we discussed this is, can something new happen in which, you know, formerly the Sangha was built of the devotees or students or disciples of a particular teacher, and the teacher was vetted and refined by their teachers and the community of teachers that may have held them, but at a certain point the teacher became independent. And maybe in our time there's a new moment where a community of teachers can create a new kind of accountability and maybe a meta-sangha, a sangha of sanghas, in which the spiritual urgency of our time can be held by all of us together in a new way, even though we might have different communities of specific practice. And we just were feeling into how vulnerable and authentic and deeply surrendered we need to be as teachers and participants, as co-venturers in this new emergent. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to just kind of presence that and offer you a chance to comment and respond.
Yeah, well, so just in just listening to what you're saying, seems like what we're, the assumptions of what you're asking me are really around spiritual realization and the forms that realization can take. And what the role of community is, can we function in a larger community with more teachers? Is that a possibility? There's probably a question about is there something that might be lost? I think one of the most reliable sources of wisdom, of course, is just to simply look at what is. So if we look at what is, and let's just use the integral world / evolutionary spirituality world, the people who are tuned into this beautiful series that you've created, that's precisely what's happening, is that there's a whole collective of people who've come to a certain level of spiritual depth, of recognition, of understanding through a number of different methodologies or forms, master disciple. Some have been called, you know, very much solitary adventures, some have been in the academy, and as a collective, we're drawing on that, the resource that's coming from many, many, many different teachers. So if we were simply in a Zen context, in a situation in which the Dharma transmission from my master, which he received from his master, if that were the only dimension we were practicing in, there'd probably be a somewhat different quality. But we are both local practitioners and global practitioners. So it's highly possible that some people on the call are doing both. But if they're doing both, there's a challenge that they're going to be experiencing, which is, you know, how do I integrate? To be in relationship to one person has its challenges, but there's a simplicity to it. The complexity of how we're doing is how I, as an individual person with a deep perfection of now, but also with an urgency to learn, to grow, to change, to evolve, you know, how do I receive instruction? How do I practice in such a way that something actually accrues in my being? You know, how do I start to manifest that both recognition, timeless space, and at the same time, this, you know, urgent evolutionary passion, which your teaching really embodies really beautifully. You know, what's beautiful about it is there's a tremendous responsibility on myself to actually do the synthesizing. So I think it's actually what is happening. I think it's not only potential, I think it's a reality. And I think the attendant reality is being the vehicle of synthesis and really taking that responsibility into your being at a very deep level, as opposed to simply sampling. And in other words, there's a need for integration on the part of all of us who are participating in this milieu, and not simply a consumer mentality, because of course the downside is we're just consumers of different spiritual points of view, and then nothing happens.
Yeah. And I know for me, as I've pressed into this, the thing that has arrived for me more and more evidently is that we even though we're drawing forward into more responsibility and a sense of, you know, I call it a trans-urgency, an urgency that is not founded in dilemma and anxiety and ego, but a kind of free urgency that rests on some real measure of awakening to a profound peace that is that liberates one from that earlier kind of anxiety. You know, that in that trans urgency, mm-hmm. I find myself in this big I don't know. You know, we need to rise to an occasion that in some ways seems so daunting. The world's problems and the kinds of intractable dynamics of cultural wars and all the rest are so tricky, and there are so many kind of spaghetti tangles of karmic bonds that seem to render the whole system just intractable, you know.
In other words, are you saying we're going to die?
Well, there is that.
That is for sure.
There is that.
Unless Michael Murphy knows something I don't, we are going to die.
Yeah, that's right. The future of the body is death.
Yes. Whether it's just my individual death or a collective death, we do have to face that. That's true. And we also transform in that process. So from a certain perspective, it's what we've always done. We've always been threatened. We've always had to evolve. We'll continue to do that and, you know, be challenged in the process and devastated in the process.
That's right. It is. And there is a kind of holding of these questions, this hanging out in this big I don't know. Also, it's like a furnace or something, like a koan that has to be answered right now, that we don't have enough of an answer to. How can we be together that really is different than how we, you know, spiritual practitioners of past generations, they remained a marginal, important cultural influence, but they didn't radically transform any of the societies in which they appeared. How can we do something more? You know, the sense that we must and that we have to care to try and that somehow we personally have some role to play. I think most of us feel that, and yet we feel a kind of wonder and mystery and, you know, a big I don't know about how we can really pull all that off. But somehow it feels important to take it to heart, to really take it in and really live with it as a burning question.
Well, I think what I feel just listening to you say that is just kind of a deep, my heart opens in relationship to the quality of the aspiration, so that we actually hold this really deep and beautiful aspiration to grow in such a way that we can actually address some of the collective problems. And what we're talking about are things that, as you just said, appear to be insurmountable. So let's just begin with worldwide poverty. You know, let's talk about racial and ethnic strife. Let's talk about arms dealing. You know, the issues, the really significant issues that afflict the quality of life for a vast majority of people on the planet on a daily basis. And that in our hearts, we can do better than that. In our hearts, somehow there should be a way to create equity and fairness, to create an environment of health, to create some kind of economic parity so people can share, have a little bit of disposable income in their pocket. I read a study recently, which I thought was interesting, which was, you know, that you can be happy, but you need $75,000. And it was sort of, for me...
Is this in New York City or Sheboygan, Wisconsin?
or Rio de Janeiro Lagos, Nigeria, like where is it? But what I took away from it is that
in my dialogue last week, I'm sorry, Sadhguru said that you could live pretty well on $2 a day where he comes from.
Well, it's true. I think it was probably somewhere in America. But what I was struck by is that, you know, if we can take care of our needs and maybe have a little something to play with, we're actually happy. You know, we do want to take care of our needs, and yet we also find that it's not sufficient just to take care of my own. And that's a beautiful flowering of spiritual development that, you know, I can't rest unless other people get to experience the same thing I experience. And that's what always turns the Dharma wheel, is that there's this natural reaching out, this natural generosity that arises from your realization. It arises from your well-being. It arises from your good fortune. It's simply in our hard drive to want to give to others what we appreciate and what we've been given. And so that, you know, that's just already such a, you know, it gives me tremendous faith in who we are.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the fact that we're probing these questions and caring to meet them, you know, I know that there's a context here where many of us who've been on the path for several decades have encountered the absolutely true and important and valid, you know, principle that we need to give up our agendas and our anxiety and our stories completely and let go into what is with a kind of liquid, spacious acceptance that just transcends, you know, all of that completely. And in that, there's a kind of radical freedom, and that the story of a moment in time where there's an special evolutionary urgency can certainly be held in an anxious and egoic way, and that does need to be surrendered to that spaciousness.
Or it
and
can
yet,
be held bodhisattva, though.
Yeah, yeah. That's the thing. I think more and more of us are feeling it somehow culturally.
Yeah.
We're in a moment where a collective bodhisattva, the next Buddha is
yeah.
a sangha. You know, that together can we hold a higher responsibility and actually enact something that hasn't been enacted in ages past or generations past.
Well, I think part of, and I'm just kind of wanting to the audience right now, but part of what I really appreciate about the Interval Sangha and the teachers within the Sangha, and not only the teachers, the practitioners, and also all the expertise, like today within the Interval world itself, and, you know, however you want to define this boundary, and it can be as vast as you're willing to let it be, but I talked to a person today who's doing Zen practice with me, who's a doctor, who also has a history of trauma and is working on, you know, deepening her understanding of how to liberate trauma from the body. You know, I talked with a person in Vancouver who's working on sustainability and non-dual philosophy. And there's a way that when we actually expand our identity to include the field, it's the problems are great and the company exquisite. You know, the people that we're getting to listen to, the people that we're learning from, and I have a couple of things that I've learned over the years that I bring to the table. Other people bring different things to the table. So one of the things I bring to the table is, you know, the recognition that comes from Buddhist practice of the sort of innate perfection and value of this moment, of this incarnation precisely as it is, and then the wish to extend that realization to others. But what I've learned from you, what I've learned from Ken, certainly from the work that Mark and I have done together, is, you know, this evolutionary trajectory in which we include everything that we're learning in time. And what's beautiful is I don't feel like I have to hold that particular expertise or that particular vision in the same way because everybody else in the field is doing it. So in the field, I'm free to invite people to feel their compassion, and I'm also really free to help pick up the shadows because that happens to be what I'm good at.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't do it in the same way Thomas does it. I don't have the passion for evolution that you have, but when I tune into you, you do have it. So therefore, we're functional.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, in other words, I'm completed by you.
Yeah. I mean, that's even what was part part of the teaching we got from Ken when, you know, it was a great honor to be invited into that core team that we were a part of. And you remember how he kind of set the context by saying, I really want this to be a second tier presentation that's truly integral, but it's impossible for me to put an integral person in front of the room, but I can assemble an integral team.
Yeah.
And it was as being a part of such a team that we really learned, you know, got to know each other and became, you know, dear Dharma buddies.
So integral is a we space. That's simply what it is. The wave of consciousness that's integral is necessarily in the collective. Because it can't be held in one person.
Yeah. And that is that complementary dynamic. And part of what I love about you is your intrepid instinct to wade right to the most difficult and conflictual energies in any we space.
Was that a compliment?
It absolutely is. Absolutely. I mean, whenever there were really difficult dynamics in those early seminars, the light and playful way you were able to engage and respectful, you know, of all the different voices in the room was always really a wonderful secret weapon.
Secret weapon.
Bringing those seminars in for a landing.
Well, the thing is, and just for our people who are listening, just because they're, you know, holding an integral intelligence and an integral understanding, one of the things we're learning is that the skillful engagement of shadow is just simply a part of how we're going to have to function, because we're at a level of consciousness where what were dualities, yes, no, good, bad, right, now become polarities. And polarities in integral consciousness have to be worked with. And I really learned that doing conflict resolution work, that there were always voices in the room that didn't want to be spoken. There were always perspectives that no one wanted to identify with. And until they did, the energy in the room was never free. And so I just had to really practice picking up the things that people didn't want to say, the points of view they didn't want to own, the sort of negative images or archetypes that people didn't want to identify with. And that as soon as I was able to do that, then all of a sudden energy started to flow. And I think it's one of the collective skills that we're starting to use. And I think in the past what we've done is when a negativity arises, what our practice has been is to cut it out, push it away, and possibly scapegoat somebody. In other words, somehow we had the privilege to try to move it out of the system. And, you know, now we have to bring that energy into the system. There's no getting rid of anything. We realize we're in a closed system. It's an open system, but it's also a closed system.
Well, there's no out to throw things. Things cannot
there's
be thrown
no out.
Out psychically or in terms of our actual physical trash.
There's no in and no out, you know? So
yeah.
All of a sudden, we don't, you know, exile's not an option, you know?
And in witnessing that and feeling into this space here, you know, I've convened this conversation. These folks get, you know, a limited opportunity to interact. We're able to take some questions. And I feel that there's a shadow in the sense that what's really wanting to happen is a whole cultural emergence in which a tremendous amount of interaction would take place, you know, and I hope to offer forums for that. I do offer forums for that, you know, when I teach. But I'm feeling that there's a shadow in the sense that we're pursuing this conversation, and that there are probably voices that feel like they're not able to get surfaced as much as they'd like, and there may even be a shadow just in the ambition of the question that I've posed, the you know, audacity to say that spiritual practice can evolve, that the ancient truths could, you know, we could go beyond awakening. and
pretty audacious.
Yeah, so there are shadows in this space, and maybe shadows in the integral community or shadows in the larger spiritual community, because there are many people on the line with us who are not explicitly readers of Ken Wilber, that, you know, people got a chance to be exposed to him in the first dialogue, but not everyone has that as a particular background. And, you know, what do you think, what are you feeling, you know, in your shadow sensing mode. What might we speak? Yeah. Well, you're like a Ghostbuster here.
Right.
I think it's
I'm
a different
ghost
movie.
And my Ghostbuster.
Yeah. What do you feel moved to speak to and begin to uncover?
Well, I would say, you know, that the beautiful discovery of shadow is that there's just an incredible amount of energy and wisdom that shadows contain, and you can't do shadow work if you don't take responsibility. So the minute that anyone is, of course there are shadows to the program. I mean, there are always shadows. We live in a reality that is fundamentally one and also makes its appearance in two. So there are those who are speaking and there are those who are listening. There are the ideas that are being vetted and there are the ideas that are being neglected. So there's always something that's outside of awareness. But in any one moment, the willingness to notice something that's outside of awareness and to bring it into awareness and to be willing to own it, but that's the key with shadow work. So anybody who's sort of maybe has some complaint, let's say, about the series because it's over, you know, what was the word you used? Overly ambitious. It's overly ambitious. Mm-hmm. You know, the first place I would want to start is to ask them about their ambition. You know, are they ambitious enough? Are they working hard enough? Or the flip, do they need to underwork? So the beautiful thing is we can all engage shadow precisely because we're all responsible. There are two moves that happen with working with polarity. And one is that the separation and the exile and the scapegoating disappears. You bring it into the system, but that it also means that everybody has to own it. It's not just simply, again, one person is not culpable. The entire system becomes culpable. And when that happens, there's just tremendous freedom. You know, there's no escape. We're all participating in it. But that takes a tremendous amount of development, in my view, for us to really know how to do that on the spot.
You know, creates a different cultural moment in which the option of complaint and withdrawal and criticism doesn't really exist in the same way. There's a curious, tender co-holding and aliveness of co-participating that connects us more, makes us more intimate.
Right, and it requires more of us because it requires us to be everything. And there are a lot of things we don't want to be. We want other people to be those things, or we want those things to be history, but in fact they're all right here right now. And in any one moment we have to be willing to identify with that which we don't want to. How can that happen? I hope that's not too abstract for people who are listening.
Well, why don't we make it a little less abstract in some way? I mean, maybe there's a story or a way that you can help make this more vivid, because I feel like this is such an important and in a way delicate kind of a process. And maybe, you know, a story of your facilitation would be fun, because I think what I said in the introduction is that Diane is an extraordinarily skilled facilitator, and what I mean by that is that I saw again and again that she would notice what was happening in the room, and there would maybe be some diversity in the room, and she would, in the most impish and funny way, she'd joke with half of the room about the feelings and projections and irritations they felt with the other half, and then joke with the other half about the way they felt about the interaction she just had with the first half. And in a few very liquid quips, you know, the whole room would come together in a way that transformed the energy. And I saw that kind of thing go on again and again and again. And that unique capacity that you've got, Di, it kind of has to do with the way you feel into the collective field, doesn't it? It has to do with your care for what's tending to be excluded, your compassion for
the
wholeness.
Yeah, and I love people, and I've learned to love that which I don't want to love, you know, and it's really hard to do. Okay, so we'll do two things. So the first is I'll just share an experience, and then you and I can work with something on the spot. How about that? So the,
okay, sure, let's go.
No, it'll be great. You'll love it. And I know everybody has a lot of practical things they're dealing with, but do not underestimate the power of consciousness, the power of awareness, the power of it as all of the integral work is in some ways based on the fact that we have such freedom of mind that we can take any perspective. And the capacity to take perspective is just a massive freedom and a massive developmental privilege. And so I want to, you know, before we get, you know, I can feel we get mired down in how things apply. We can get to how things apply, but just feel for a minute that the absolute radical freedom, the play, the creativity that comes from the ability to take different perspectives, to put your mind into the space, into another space. I mean, it's an incredible thing. So the first story that I want to share is one that we experimented with this summer, and actually which we're going to be doing at the Integral Spiritual Experience in January as well. And I'll be really looking forward to seeing you there, and I'm hoping people will come to this particular event because we actually get to enact and practice some of these things. But basically what happened is that I used the Big Mind process to explore the whole spectrum of the issue around, let's call it the gay-straight dynamic. And so using the experience of both the majority, you could call it the majority of the straight reality and the minority of being homosexual or in same-sex relationships or transgendered. And basically what I did is because we had a number of gay people, gay plus, I'm just going to call it gay as opposed to, I can never do the letters, LGBTB or whatever, gay plus. We had a number of people who were in our community together, and we just wanted to inquire into the dynamics of that. So basically what I did is I asked to speak to everybody at the same time. We spoke to the straight mind and how the straight mind experiences reality. And then we spoke to the homophobic mind so that everybody identified with homophobia and the part of us that has a, just because it's a minority position, just has a some part of us that wants to cringe out of what it is that's not the so-called norm. And then I spoke to everybody, invited everyone to speak as their gay identity, to really identify with being in a same-sex or an alternative configuration that wasn't the so-called norm, and what the energy of that was and what the feeling of that was. And it was really, really powerful and moving to actually see that each of us has the capacity to drop into those different points of view. And the people in the experience who were gay said it was one of the most touching things they'd ever experienced, because they had actually never been in a room where they'd had straight people identify with what it's like to be gay. And we were also able to do some kind of conversation around, you know, just the negativity that goes back and forth between, it's not just simply one way, because after a long history of being gay and experiencing a lot of, as you know, everything from attack to gay bashing to murder, you know, that there's a lot of animosity that flows from the gay community to the straight community as well. So, you know, what did it mean for us all to kind of venture into that together? So that would be an example, for instance, of how to work with shadow in the field so that we all identify with the positions that nobody wants to take. So that's one example.
Now you deal in a very high level with that in teaching circumstances where people are already open to integral perspectives, because there's a lot of self-awareness implied in that. But you also deal in as a mediator sometimes in situations where people don't have any of that sophistication, and you're probably dealing with, very traditionalist or egocentric kind of values that are kind of unrepentantly.
Well, the dynamics of threat and safety are the same. It doesn't matter what level of development. So you just have to kind of change the conversation at a certain level to, and that's part of what people who are integrally informed are trying to do, is like, how do we actually find the language and the forms for different kind of different levels of development. Because even at an integral level, when I feel threatened, I'm threatened. And when I feel relaxed and exploratory, I'm relaxed and exploratory. So it's a matter of kind of dialing into the conceptual constructs that have meaning, if you will. Does that make sense, Terry? I hope I'm not.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it has a lot of relevance to the conversation that I've convened here, because in a way, it's all about a situation in which we all feel threatened by something that is bigger than us. That, you know, it's not like we're specific. The big threat isn't each other, and yet our inability to become coherent is a big part of what threatens us. So we're also frustrated with each other. But the threat is something that could, on one level, bring us together rather than separate us. And I wonder if you see how that might function. Like, can our, you know, one of the questions that we sometimes ask is, under conditions of threat, people tend to revert to lower levels of operation. They tend to be more fear-based, more reactive, less wise, less open, less spacious, less free. But sometimes facing a common threat brings people together, and we have both of those dynamics at work in what's emerging in our time. Can we be more intimate because we're here in this beautiful miracle of existence that in which we have so much privilege and yet so much is at stake, and we all at times feel afraid together? Does that give us a new access, maybe to a new level of courage and perhaps cooperation?
Well, you have to tell me, because you're the evolutionary person. I'm not evolutionary. I'm just basically.
Well, wait a second here. You may not be the individual in the integral conversation who especially holds that particular piece of things, but I wouldn't absolve you of evolutionary responsibility. I'm sorry.
I'm the shadow cowgirl.
That's
I gallop
right.
in on my black horse and do shadow work when everything's falling apart.
That's not certainly in my job description. Your union card tells you don't have to deal with that. No.
Well, let's look at it from my perspective, and then we'll look at it from yours, and then we'll do a little shadow exercise. But let's say that our massive material success has a shadow or a dualism, which is the massiveness of the threat. So in a certain way that our, you know, exploding into 6+ billion people, now that's like some serious success, you know, as far as from a biological perspective. And from at the same time, the threat is equally as large. So the challenge comes down in a certain way to, you know, can we. So the challenge has always been a challenge of heart, you know. How do I deal with the dualism of reality? How do I deal with, you know, pain and suffering and the massive love that I feel in terms of being a human being and I think Jesus' instruction about loving this world, and I love it so much, and I don't want people to suffer, and I really, really, really care. You know, so that the only way to deal with this dualism is through the heart, and we know that. You know, the heart is the metabolic function that can help us resolve that dualism, but we have to do it collectively. We don't get to stand in our individual or in our small groups. We have to have heart on a larger level. We have to actually be networked through the internet and holding a heartfelt space in terms of this transformative process that we're in. Because every time there's a death, there's a rebirth. So if there's a huge cataclysm of reality, you know, if the megatropolis is of Bogota and Lagos and Shanghai and L.A., you know, if that, you know, mega catastrophe, you know, becomes even a greater catastrophe, there's a transformative energy at work. We know that. We trust that. We've all lived with that. And yet what it means on a day-to-day basis to create a strong network of loving and response and, you know, moving in ways where we don't, you know, to the extent that we can, just work with what is and take care of each other in the face of all that. That's always been our spiritual challenge. So that's my perspective, but I'd be interested in yours, because you've been having these conversations, and I come from a very particular point of view about how we work with this large challenge that we face.
Well, you know, I think that it's interesting that you stated it that way, because that was almost exactly the point of view that was put forward by Howard Martin and Debbie Rosman of the Institute of Heart Math just about a week ago. We had a.
Are you Carrie? Are you saying I'm redundant?
No, I'm saying you're convergent.
Oh, sure, it was
original. That's even better. That's even better.
Okay. Anyway, go ahead.
That's even better than being original, Di. It's to be convergent.
Oh, convergent. Okay, good.
Yeah, convergent. You know, what emerges converges in evolutionary speak. This newness kind of comes out in this diversity and then comes back together.
Yeah.
I think for me, right. It is a heart matter. That's the whole thing that it's been my care for the whole that's drawn me into teaching in the first place and into this sense that spiritual practice has to become a kind of activism, and yet that activists who are primarily focused on the exteriors usually need to refocus on practice more in order for their participation to be lit by a kind of spirit that can meet the kinds of challenges we have now. So in some context, I think I'm beating the drum of spiritual awakening, and in others, the drum of social responsibility with this deep heart of care, this sense that our moment is pregnant with something new, too. I think I feel myself alive not just in the involutionary, timeless source of all things, which is a kind of freedom, but in the evolutionary emergent, giving birth to something new. Like, there is, I think, a new spirituality emerging out of modernity and postmodernity, and it is the same in its soul as the ancient spirituality, but it's got newness to it, and it is alive, and something is happening that hasn't happened before. So I don't feel that I hold evolution any more than you do. I mean, I think anybody who's authentically alive in the not knowing and emergent of a new kind of responsibility too. Like, don't we have a role as educated people with such mobility and such access to information and such lives of privilege to give back somehow? And to give back in a crucial moment when this corner needs to be turned. That feels so alive to me, and yet that there is controversy. I mean, there are people on one side of the aisle, kind of Andrew Cohen, you know, really articulates this, that this ecstatic urgency is the whole point. And then you've got like Sadhguru, who I just spoke with in my last dialogue on Tuesday, who's kind of saying that the ineffable truth of being was seen into by the ancient rishis in a way that could never be transcended, and that we simply need to reach decision makers, you know, that the profound essence of spirituality couldn't evolve because it's always been a marriage of the absolute and the evolving, the dynamic. And so there are controversies, and can we come together in some agreement that's big enough to hold those controversies? Do we have an ability to be fierce warriors of emergence that are founded in the eternity of joy that is the source of the love that we feel in a simple way, you know, the care, the simple.
Well, there are three identities that I think we could pick up, that you and I could pick up, and if we picked them up sequentially, it might be interesting. So the first, of course, is the one who knows, and the one who comes from privilege, and the one who has access to information, and the one who is actually both burdened and gifted with leading in terms of how we navigate the challenges we face. So that's one voice. The other voice is one you expressed really in the beginning of the call, which is the voice of the fool, which is just saying, I don't know. Hell, I have no idea.
The one who doesn't know, yeah.
The one who doesn't know, and basically the one who doesn't know and who knows that, you know, we know this, who knows that anything I could know is not sufficient, right?
Right.
And then there's the third voice, which is just simply the voice of care, you know, and the voice of offering what I have to offer and, you know, trusting that somehow that if I put my heart on the line, that's sufficient in its insufficiency. But if I just put my heart on the line, that's what I can do. And so on the one hand, you know, I was just in Brazil and in Sao Paulo and also in Rio, and I think Sao Paulo is 20 million and Rio is, I don't know how many million, but 20% of the people in Rio live in favelas, in slums, basically. And, you know, like, there's something about it, it's just not okay.
Yeah. Really not
okay. It's just not okay, you know? It's not okay. And yet they're also living, and that's okay. You know, my father has cancer. He's not ready to die. He's trying to make his peace with it. You know, he's trying to find a way. He's actually been a person who's been extremely dedicated to this reality. And he just has no particular relaxation around dropping his body. And, you know, he's looking to me a little bit furtively and kind of saying, you know, I don't have a reference point for how to do this. And he's fragile and he's vulnerable. And he's being honest about it, but it's just true.
Yeah.
So I've got favelas on one hand and I've got my dad on the other. And then I have my own human heart in the middle.
Beautiful, yeah. Ah!
So, you know, I think you and I could take some leadership by just conveying to people that we do need to work on what we know and we do need to evolve our technologies and our understanding, sustainability, trauma, you know, political sensibility, finding new forms to do politics. And at the same time, your life is sufficient. Exactly it is. And if you can feel that sufficiency, then you really have something to offer to others. And that's, you know, that's where the heart of our spiritual practice is.
Yeah, that's true. It's interesting. There's something very beautiful, and I feel this deep, bittersweet quality. I'm reminded of my teacher's phrase, the wound of love, in which deep, deep, deep okayness and deep rest and deep, in a sense, deep happiness. So, like the sufficiency really is sufficient to the heart, sufficient to the stress we feel, sufficient to everything, that being is such a gift, that even a moment of this precious embodied existence, oh, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, you know, that to the nth degree. And then simultaneously, we're in a moment where we need to respond. There are clarities we don't have that we need. I want to help in ways I don't know how to help. I need to move
forward. That's what I mean about
forward.
You're evolutionary. Well, I think that's right.
Well, isn't it the both and, though? Yeah.
It's absolutely, absolutely. That's what I'm saying, though, but that you can move to that voice and pick that up so powerfully is what I look to you for. You know, I look to you for that precisely because, you know, the compassion is that, you know, we're talking about how do we create a network, or we create a virtual reality, or we create a nervous system of love, you know, across the web. You know, that where people who are tuned in this particular way have a place they can hook into, and that I can be really served by the urgency to serve, and that you can be reminded of how utterly okay it is.
Yeah.
You know, at the same moment. But yeah, I'm with you. I do want to serve, and I don't know how. You know, and it's bewildering. And you know, and we should challenge each other. You know, at the same time, it's not enough. You know, there is more to. We have more capacity. I mean, I think that's partly what I hear when I hear the those of us in our community who are, you know, inviting this, you know, deeper commitment to evolution are saying, come on, people, like, let's get a feel for what capacity we actually have, as opposed to being satisfied with the way things are. You know, how much more are we capable of? And that is an awesome question.
Yeah, that is the question. And maybe the most fruitful thing we can do, I mean, I love this, Di. Thank you so much. I think you've been beautiful and together, you know, I feel like we've just dropped into something very core here. And then, you know, we are members of a community of integral practitioners and teachers and inquirers, and we've seen the wounds and stucknesses of ourselves and others. I mean, we're not, we have concrete and tangible and specific steps forward that we can take, and you know, that these principles can be embodied in flesh and blood and time and space and here and now. And what are your cutting edges? What are the shadows and opportunities and places of courage and alignment for you right now?
Oh, in my life, right this moment. Well,
have I asked an unfair question?
He's been unfair. No, you haven't asked an unfair question. You've asked a really pertinent question. I mean, part of my cutting edge is just grieving nature. You know, I grieve that we're such a force that the natural world is disappearing. That's a cutting edge for me. Accompanying my father through his dying process is a cutting edge for me. You know, within our community and the larger vision that we're working on, I think my cutting edge is just precisely what you're talking about, which is what are the ways, where is my capacity greater? What do I need in terms of relationship and instruction to activate more capacity? And how do I keep from just becoming a materialist of spirituality? You know, Chogyam Trungpa always been cautioning all of us, you know, around that any time our spirituality starts to take on a quality of attainment, that we're probably in trouble, because it's an acquisitive kind of gesture as opposed to relinquishment. And the deeper we let go, the more is revealed. So, you know, I'm in a big kind of knot of love and karmic confusion. You know, I don't have the clarity that some people have. I have more of the bewilderment and the submission to something bigger than I am, and the kind of humility that comes with feeling like you've had your ass kicked. You know, and that's just my temperament. You know? It's like I like to kick ass and then feel like I've been beaten up, you know.
That's right. Watch out, people. Now, if you want to fight with Diane, take a look at her shoes. They're very pointy. She has cowboy boots.
Exactly. But then I go throwing my weight around, which is not very significant, and then go home feeling beat up, you know. So, I don't know. I'm just in awe of all of it. I love people. I love what we're up to. I love that we're all seriously engaged. I love that our hearts are on the line. You know, I'd like to see us, you know, figure some things out. And in a funny way, I just feel like we're just, you know, from a kind of more humble perspective, that we're just experiencing the particular dilemma of our time, and there's always this inclination to want it to be greater, and that's precisely what draws us forward. You know, so I'm a little bit of the back of the bus type, you know, saying we're all right, you know, we're doing fine. Well, what's true in your life in terms of your cutting edge?
Well, you know, I think I feel, certainly there have been so many chapters in the process of my unfolding, and this teleseminar itself was an act of boldness in a certain way, you know, a kind of...
Cojones is the word of the day.
There you go.
Or cojones, depending on how you...
Whether you
apparently,
can pronounce
you know,
Spanish, yeah.
Yeah, what's the thing that they're telling everybody to do to man up? You know,
yeah, there you go.
You've manned up on the series.
In some ways, I have, I had to do a reframe on ambition. I've had to realize that my care about this moment in that feeling of radiant inspiration to be of service needs to find expression. I need to really take it seriously and try to make a tangible difference, and that a cultural movement that isn't merely, you know, past movements have been motivated by ideologies that have been pretty limited, and I don't really want us to recreate that. And yet I can see that we've got to mobilize the heroism that's in our hearts, and I'm feeling that I've got to try to help us come together in that.
And well, you should, and I support you, and that's exactly what they were doing, and there's all, no, but we're doing it at a different moment in time with a different level of consciousness, and there's always, you know, the piece that's outside of our awareness, right?
Yeah,
so
you
have to do it knowing that there's more in your awareness, and there's still so much that isn't there.
That's true, and that's what has in the past held me back from acting. I think that probably my cutting edge is that awareness of my own incompleteness, that inevitably acting will create some shadow effects, has, you know, I've realized that that's let me leave aspects of my gift ungiven, and I'm no longer able to do that. And yet I feel very, you know, it's like a G-force, you know, my face is distorted by it's kind of pushed back my face muscles. This is the intensity of really going for it and acting in the midst of some humble awareness that I can't help but make mistakes, that I can't help but display the aspects of me that are incomplete, the shadows of my own awareness, that in some way to act is to enter into the karmic domain and to create karma, even as much as you do it all, guided by and in service of Dharma.
Mm-hmm.
I feel very, you know, I feel very
well. You know,
by
you
that.
Know. I mean, I don't know if I'm right because I'm a Buddhist, as you know, not a Hindu. But isn't that the conversation between Krishna and Arjuna?
It sure is.
At the
remember
beginning of the
me and
Gita.
Fight. Remember me and fight. So the admonition.
And Arjuna saying,
right
"No, I don't want to do that. It's like not good for humans. We don't want to do this thing.
I don't want to kill my cousins. I don't want to create karma. I don't want to hurt anyone. I don't want to act because in acting there will be karma. That's what he's
exactly.
saying.
That's exactly right.
Yep.
And that's true. There will be.
Yeah. That's right. Well, I think that all of us are up against an Arjuna Krishna moment. I think that Krishna is not just talking to me here. I think he's talking to everybody on the line.
No, you're up
you,
against
me, and everybody.
No, you're up against an Arjuna Krishna moment, and I'm just going to the bar.
Yeah, but you brought me, so you're up against the moment too.
Oh, okay, you're right. We already established that it's the collective dilemma. So we're...
Oh, Di, so fun to be on the line with you. Well, we have reached the moment when I, even though I just want to keep going, want to open up the line so others can join us. So,
I thought for sure you were going to ask me some questions about the feminine.
Well, let's do that in the half an hour to come. We've got time here.
I don't have anything to say.
The mean feminine.
The mean feminine.
If you're listening over the web, this is the opportunity to go ahead and type out a concise question in the instant teleseminar window, starting now. And before we begin answering the questions, I have a few things I'd like everybody to know about, because we're coming to you free because of the generosity of our wonderful sponsors, including the Institute of Noetic Sciences, or IONS. IONS invites us all to join free. They have a brand new, improved website with a lot of assets on it. And going there, you can explore the science of inner knowing. And when you become a member of this conscious community, you connect with like-spirited individuals exploring three program areas that offer enormous potential for positive change: consciousness and healing, worldview transformation, and extended human capacities. IONS hosts a global community where people connect, learn, and transform through live and online programs, and membership is free. So sign up today at noetic.org. That's N-O-E-T-I-C, noetic.org. And calling in the one, join women's transformation and empowerment pioneers Claire Zammit and Catherine Woodward Thomas for a free 75-minute teleseminar, Calling in the One: How to Identify and Release Your Hidden Barriers to Love and Become a Magnetic to Your Soulmate. On this free call, you'll discover what the hidden barriers to love are and how you can release them. Let Calling in the One show you how to move beyond old patterns in love and in life so you can attract and sustain the kind of powerful, loving, and spiritual partnership that will catapult you toward the full realization of your destiny. Join Claire and Catherine this Monday, November 1st, for an exclusive free 75-minute teleclass and find out for yourself how to access the power to call in the one. So to register and for more information, go to callinginTheOne.com/teleseminar. That's callinginTheOne.com/teleseminar. And finally, this Sunday, in just 2 days, at a different time, at 11 a.m. Pacific time, and please remember, daylight savings time will end the night before, so be sure to reset your clocks. This gives us an extra hour of sleep this time, though, so it shouldn't be too painful. This will be 7 p.m. Central European time. Be sure to tune in for the next dialogue in this series. I'll be talking with the most wonderful Brother David Steindl-Rast, live from Vienna. He'll be joining us live from Vienna on gratefulness and open heart and cultural transformation. And I'll tell you more about that at the end of this call. Okay. We have a bunch of great questions here from all over the world, Di.
Do we really?
We do. We have really, really great questions. And so it maybe try to give wonderful short answers so we can get a bunch of them in. Darlana from Hilo, Hawaii, asks, thank you so much for teaching us today. I've heard for many years that Buddhism is the world's most psychologically sophisticated religion, also the fastest growing religion. I'm not sure that's true. Assuming this is true, my question is, why isn't Buddhism producing more Buddhas, or any Buddhas, she says? Why aren't more people waking up? What's the holdup? I'm not trying to be fresh. I just really want to know.
Well, my answer is there are tons of Buddhas. There are six billion Buddhas. So I think that Buddhism actually doesn't produce Buddhas. Buddhism just helps people see the Buddhas that already exist. And I think from that perspective, it's doing its job, and it's doing a great job.
Mm. And is there a sense that the path could be more fruitful more quickly, or do you share any of her perception, or is that it?
Well, you told me to give a short answer.
That was really short.
It was short. Well, I think our job is to, as much as it is to be, you know that great old story by Ram Dass, right? Ram Dass and his student, where his student
yes.
is Jewish, and Ram says, how is your mother doing with your Buddhism? And the student says, well, she doesn't like my Buddhism, but she loves it when I'm the Buddha.
Yeah,
I would say to our caller that the test is to be the Buddhas, to be the Buddha and to see them. Mm. That's it.
Great. Now, Roth from Paris asks, do you really mean that the integral can't be held in the individual, or rather that it is currently rare in the individual, or that it is more powerfully realized in the collective or amplified in the we space?
I think he's
referring to what we said about not putting out an integral individual but an integral team.
Oh, well, it's exactly the same. The very fact that he's emailing me a question from Paris, it's just precisely the same phenomenon. So it's just simply that our consciousness is extending and we're having a much more broad, energetic, geographic, global, and because of that, all the challenges are simply in that same domain. You know, we have the individual ones, but the place where our attention is extended is precisely where our challenges are. It's simply the phenomenon of being a global virtual culture, which we are now. So, Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think I would maybe add that.
Yeah, please.
I think that the integral is that we are embodying integral as individuals, but that if we are to teach integral, we're to exemplify integral, because everybody's expression is so unique, we are together a matrix out of which the field that can be evocative to the integral expression of all the different individuals is just much richer. But that doesn't mean that you're not integral or I'm not integral. It's just that he didn't feel that he could evoke, that Ken didn't feel that he could evoke, that he could create a seminar experience that would evoke the integral opportunity of all the different individuals without a whole team of people whose different integral expressions would knit together.
Well, I think that that's precisely the point. So I answered the question, but I think you're more on it, Terry. So it's happening in this moment, which is Terry's understanding is actually refining and delivering to the question in a way that mine isn't, and that when we start to realize that as we look around, that somebody's subtle body that's developed, Ken's this massive cognitive capacity. Other colleagues of ours have incredible heart. We have people who are bodied, and then there's just this massive realm of expertise that there's just simply no way that one person can hold what's needed, and that we just really have to learn how to support each other more clearly for what our respective gifts are.
Beautiful. Well, here's another question I'd like to invite you to maybe not feel so obliged to be super brief in answering. I really spooked you there.
Hey, if I have a spiritual teacher near me and they give me an instruction, I do it.
Yeah, well, it's beautiful. We're coming along here. I used to be the devotee, and you were the first Dharma warrior.
I've become the disciple.
That's great. Rebecca Jane from Manchester in the UK.
Oh, wow.
Says, most people do not recognize their own shadow. How can we see our own?
Well, the whole point is that you don't see it, right? You don't see it because it's simply outside of your awareness. So you have to do a kind of a sleight of hand. You know, you can't look at, you can't see it. That's precisely the point. So you've got some pretty bad options. One is you can look to your dreams. One is you can look to events in the world that activate you. You can look to body symptoms. But the way that we teach it and work with it a lot is to just simply look to those people who are irritating you in the field, right? Find out what it is that's irritating you. That kind of disturbance is usually some indication of shadow. And if you're really, really, really brave, I don't recommend it. Ask your friends.
They'll answer and they'll tell you.
They'll tell you, and I hate to give you the bad news. They're all going to agree.
there we have it. Well, that's
a bad
beautiful
moment.
Well, we have some other really great questions from the folks listening on webcast, but before we go back to them, I'd like to give the folks who have called in on the telephone a chance to raise their hands. So, please make sure you're offering a question rather than a commentary, and raise your hand by pressing *2 on your telephone.
Keep your questions short.
Well, Here, we have a question from Joshua Ruthier in Lansing, Michigan. Joshua,
all right.
Come right on the line.
Hello?
Hi. You're
hey.
On the air.
Hey, yeah, I sent in a message, too, so you probably ignore that. I wanted to ask, this is a big piece for me right now, and I wanted to ask how does one deal with shadow consciously in romantic relationship? That seems to be something that I've dealt with in previous relationships poorly. And as of late, especially after sort of this shift in awareness in working with Samuel Bonder's group, there's been this way in which I've sort of become very at a core level aware of the fact that I have some attachment issues, some insecure sort of anxious attachment. I'm just wondering, how does one stay conscious with that, and how does one work with that in relationship?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there are many, many different ways, right? There are many different ways to work. In where I grew up, it's a bit of a crude expression, but we say there's more than one way to skin a cat. So, tell me your first name again.
My name is Joshua.
Joshua. So there are a couple things, all right? So what we're talking about in terms of shadow is just simply that which we identify with and that which we don't, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when we talk about being insecure in your attachment, it means being needy, right? Being emotionally, energetic, needy, needing to connect. And so that's one side of the pole, is being able to pick up the one who's really needy, the one who is, you know, like a baby needs to nurse or to, you know, needs to be held in a particular way. So like actually trying to kind of find that part of yourself and being able to identify with it. But then the flip is also true, right? So then I would also encourage you to pick up the one who actually is really motherly and really generous and really giving and knows how to hold and knows how to care, and that's also part of your identity. So I would work with that polarity if it were me.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's fantastic. Wow, thank you so much. I've been working with this piece for a while and really been feeling into it, and it just feels so pervasive. It seems to be something that influences not just my romantic relationships, but every aspect of relationship with any human being.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something I've been wanting to work around. I'm going to be at ISE this year. I was the one that won the tickets from Teleconference of Love stuff, and I wanted to.
Good for
I was hoping
you.
To kind of. Thank you. I was hoping to work some of this stuff out before I got there so I could really just be present with the event, but that seems like a really great start. Thank you so much.
Well, let me just say one more thing to you, okay? Because when you talk about that kind of anxiousness and nervousness and how it affects your relationships, this is what's so beautiful about the integral model, is we're also talking about your nervous system, right? And we're talking about how your nervous system experiences relationship in itself. And so you're going to want to work with somebody also who can teach you really how to soothe yourself and how to work with really relaxing your nervous system. So there's the relational dimension, there's the intrapsychic dimension of really working with the identities, there's how you interact and practice with your partners and your friends, and then you really need to also include some kind of self-soothing. Because it's all around how you experience being held. Okay?
Okay. Yeah. Is there any particular practice you might
thank
suggest?
Thank you, Joshua. No, I think we need to get on to some other callers, but thank you so much. That was a rich exchange. Really appreciate
the
question.
Hi, Joshua. Sorry.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's go to one of the questions from the Instant Teleseminar window. Masoom in Mumbai asks, the question I have is the exercise of consciously practicing and planning, creating and not creating karma, a natural process? If he's, and this doesn't quite make syntactical sense, but maybe we can get a feeling for what he means. He types, would we then be missing some of our life's learning?
That one's for you.
Well, you know, I think I get what he's kind of saying. Isn't this process of remember me and fight an inherently natural process? And if we tried not to create karma, wouldn't we miss our life's learning? Isn't that what you get from it? Yeah.
Yeah. Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. Absolutely. In other words, let's see. What's the best way to respond to this? Basically, you have to know in yourself the karma and the place that's also, you're so at one with your karma that it's almost like there is no karma because you're so deeply at home in it. As you said, I like that you use the word natural. So it's just very natural. Of course there's karma and you're also one with your karma, so there's no problem. So I don't know if I can do better than that, Terry. How about you?
I think you did great. I don't really have too much to add. I think that and what we said before, this sense of being aware, you know, this real desire to help and not create harm and knowing that there are karmic repercussions when we act, but being willing and kind of courageous to just let ourselves be here, you know, foibled and incomplete and limited though we may be, we've got to give it our best shot. We've got to find ways to embody love the best we can, and we will not do it perfectly, and the universe will give us feedback.
Right, exactly. And to pick up the identity, and this is one, a shadow voice that I work with a lot, is the shadow of the injurer, because none of us want to be the one that does harm. And yet, every one of us were born in the moment giving pain to our mother.
That's right.
You know, so there's a certain dimension where we can't get out of that. So you have to somehow own it, that by being who you were, you created suffering for your siblings. You disappointed your parents. You haven't been who your wife wants you to be. Like, to somehow own that particular part in a certain way frees us at the same time.
Beautiful. Well, we have a question from someone whose name I don't know in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. You're on the air. What's your question? Please let us know your name.
Hi, my name is Shika. My question, I'll try to keep it as concise as possible. It's actually related to the last one. And I think it's something about if we're going to act, really understanding maybe what it is specifically that we need to transform, like that, like for example, somebody mentioned poverty, and I don't know that it's the poverty itself, but maybe that there's perhaps that there's a way that we as individuals can relate to one another in a way that would not allow poverty, if that makes sense. Mm.
What I hear in what you're saying, Shika, is that where we're restricted is in our consciousness, and where we're depleted is in our consciousness, and that to the extent that we can grow in consciousness, every moment, every situation is completely full. And there may be more available to us in that domain, regardless of our material circumstances. Am I right about what I just said? Terry, do you have anything you want to say about that?
Well, you know, I kind of feel that we're really tender. It's hard to be a person, and all of us are wounded in different ways, and we express it in different ways. Some people seem intact and healthy and robust and unwounded, but everybody's got a story that'll break your heart, as Melissa Etheridge, her great song says, you know, and that I think that our spirituality is a matter of us dropping into our humanity and our wounded and broken parts, as well as opening to our transpersonal awakeness, and that the that heightened sensitivity and the courage to engage life. You know, there's no courage if you're not afraid, and there's no heroism if you're not in some way kind of risking hurt or feel the reality of your mortality and vulnerability. And so there's just something in the delicacy of those things in play that comes forward. I don't really have a lot of advice to give. I just want to witness my feeling connection to those important quantities.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Shika. I think I'd like to take another question from the Instant Teleseminar window. Allison from Cusco, Peru, asks, can you give us some very simple techniques for working with the shadow elements of consciousness that could work with the most intellectually and culturally impoverished people? I live in Peru, and as a healer and teacher, I'm mostly working with tourists or travelers or the higher middle classes. Mm-hmm. However, I witness the poorest people on a daily basis who see this kind of work as the privilege of the wealthy, a sort of them and us mentality about it, and I'd really like to reach out to them. How could I work with these people?
In terms of, I'm a little bit unclear, is she talking about working with shadow, or is she talking about just identifying working with shadow?
I think she was talking, you know, it may be that you would respond that some other kind of work rather than shadow work is the place to begin, I don't know. But I think she is asking for techniques for helping people with shadow and helping people feel that they have access to it without necessarily having the same level of education and sophistication. And maybe with higher levels of trauma in their bodies and minds.
Mm-hmm. I guess what's coming up for me is in terms of one of the things about doing cross-cultural work. So what I hear in the question is that the person is that there's something of a cultural boundary that you're wanting to cross, that you're wanting to move into a different cultural milieu and experience and identify in that culture and exchange in that culture. So I probably would look at the polarities of what my stereotypes about those people are, what are the ways that I'm romanticizing them, and what are the ways that I'm actually maybe putting them down a little bit. And then I would also look at what is it I'm wanting to give and what is it I'm wanting to receive. And, you know, to just kind of explore those as almost an entryway into doing cross-cultural work. And then what you'll find is that you can just simply meet people on the terms of your meeting, you know, without a lot of baggage, cultural baggage. And that's really the biggest challenge of doing cross-cultural work, is to actually extricate, you know, the deeply held biases, both positive and negative, that we hold, so that once you've extricated and made those conscious, you free them so that you can just simply encounter people in a really basic human way. And people feel that. There's a certain moment when the cultural boundaries dissolve and it's just two hearts and two striving human beings who have a lot in common. So I would really support you in crossing that boundary, but I would ask you to look at some of the beliefs that you hold about that.
Beautiful. I think that really is complete. I don't want to add anything. I would like to take a question from Gary Davis in Burlington, Vermont. You're on the line with us live.
Oh, thank you so much. I made a whole page of notes here about what you're saying. And I was particularly interested in your talk about need for integration. And you also said we need to give up our stories, which is, to me, very interesting, because it seems to me that we have very limited stories given the world that we live in. And you also said we're in a closed system which is, again, indication of the stories that we have. I happen to be a World War II veteran, and I gave up the story of the war game, which is played by the nations. So I went out of that system, became stateless, and declared myself a world citizen. And I thought that one of the things that you mentioned in that context was that there's a need for integration. And how do we manifest that integration? And also, I think you mentioned the dialectic between local and global. So my question is very simple. Since it's self-evident that we all have major problems, globally, and
I don't have any.
Well, the problems kind of unite us. I'm talking in a social terms and a political term, really.
Okay, good.
And particularly, you talked about we will die, which is true, of course. But what is it that dies? Of course, it's our body that dies, and our bodies are within the framework of time and space. But certainly our awareness or consciousness itself, that's another question. So my question is, given the problems that we all face, particularly the problem of survival itself, how would you word the story, the new story that we all now have to realize in the terms of the one world and the one humanity of which we're a part?
Thank you, Gary. I think that's clear. That's really helpful. Thank you.
Good.
Yeah, the one story. I can't help it. I just have a huge question. Were you in the Europe or were you in the Pacific?
No, I was in Europe. I was a B-17 bomber pilot.
You were in Europe.
In Europe, yeah. I'm flying out of London.
I see. This is the interesting thing. So I'm going to try to make this short, okay? What's your first name?
His name
Gary
is Gary. Gary Davis. Like
Gary,
a blues
okay.
singer.
Blues singer. Okay, Gary, so here's the thing. All right, so the story, one of the things that's important in development, this is what we've learned, is that there's a process where we identify, we disidentify, and then we re-identify. So in terms of your story, so you were identified as a World War II pilot. You saw the devastation and the impossibility of that. You disidentified and you became a world citizen. And in your trajectory, reintegrating that story along with your world citizenness is really important because we use this concept called transcend and include. So we don't, any of us that are moving to a global story, that global story has to include our local story. But it's our local story is told from another level. So you go back and retell the story of your experience from a new place, and that's true for all of us. So transcend and include is really the key to how we tell this story because it can't just simply be a story of a world citizen. It has to be a story of my life, of my culture's life, and of the world that I belong in, and also beyond that.
You know, there's something I'd like to add to that because I'm thinking a lot about how to phrase this story. I think that we're learning it and that we're crafting it and that there are going to be both single statements of the story that large numbers of us will be able to identify with and also unique expressions for many different people, and that there'll probably be several different versions of the story for people in different cultures and in different mindsets and different worldviews. But one structure of public narrative is to tell the story of me, the story of us, and the story of now. And I think that we each have a different story of me, that we can maybe have some clarities about our story of us and also about our story of now. And I've been really trying to bring that questions about our story of us and now to bear with a lot of different stories of me, you know, in the play, in this series. And I hope that you can see that this is not Not something we'll boil down and answer in one final way, but something, it's a process, and this story is evolving. It's a river that needs to keep flowing, I think.
Right, good. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Gary.
I'd like to take one more question, Di. On the Instant Teleseminar window, we have a question from Kane in Salt Lake City.
No.
Who,
my hometown.
Who asks, Diane and Terry, thank you for this conversation. I wanted to ask you about your view on what you each see from your unique perspectives about what is the most needed concrete step that can be taken to bring together the integral we in a more powerful way.
I would answer that by saying if the integral community would give me a salary of $250,000 a year, I think that would really do it.
I should say you speak for me.
But if you guys were willing to come together to pay me, I think that I could really, that would serve everybody. That's my answer.
Okay, I think we need a better answer, Di.
Sorry,
I'm afraid I don't accept that.
Right. You go first, and then I'll answer.
I go first.
The one, you know, I take these instructions so seriously. The one most important thing. So go ahead.
Well, you know, I think that we have to keep venturing and taking risks and making ourselves vulnerable and interest, you know, in service of this greater thing that's bigger than ourselves and really transcending our own diverse interests, you know, in our $250,000 a year. I mean, that's a dream. That's a dream.
They said you could be happy with 75, so I figure, you know, triple that.
You ought to be really happy.
I should be fine. I'll be able to share my happiness.
Well, you know, I really think that it's a coming together in really serious, vital, caring service of something that we need each other and know we need each other in order to accomplish, and really making ourselves kind of open and vulnerable and in a way pretty transparent, such that the field that we are co-creating is really able to be fruitful, where the new emergents have real receptive field in which to show up. And so there's a kind of I think that there are some experiments in the Sangha of Sanghas, in the Metta Sangha, that are probably the most concrete step that I see. Which has to do with things like Ken was trying to do with Integral Spiritual Center before, but I think we have to come together in spiritual community in a way that unites practitioners of diverse approaches, and that requires a kind of surrender of the different teachers into a field in a way that we haven't done before. So I think that there's a new kind of level of spiritual dialogue that, you know, we've done some of, but I think we need to go a lot further in that. That would be the place that first rises up for me. What do you think?
I'm going to answer it from an I perspective and from a we perspective. So I think for me that my cutting edge, I think in my spiritual life, but also in terms of the integral community, is to, you know, I have to keep liberating the experience of feeling hurt. You know, whenever I engage people, and it doesn't matter whether it's the integral community or my family or whoever it is, that when I get in close, I get hurt. And then when I get hurt, I withdraw or I fall away or whatever. So my cutting edge in terms of developing the we has to do with that I need to actually start to let something go or change something there. And I would say in the larger community, I just think we need more intensive spiritual practice together. More meditation, more prayer, more really, really dropping into the fundamentals of spiritual practice so that we can enjoy the gifts of postmodernism and modernity and everything we know, but with a really, really deep realization of the timelessness. And for Cain, I would ask him to ask himself what the thing he needs to do is, so that it's
that's
an
right.
I and a we.
Exactly. That's beautiful. I love. I think what you said about working with our hurt is so beautiful, and maybe a beautiful way to end, because it's so personal and real. Because
yeah.
We're out of time, so there I have some things to offer, and I hope we'll all be able to say goodbye to one another. But before I do that, I'd like to offer a few reminders. If you're interested to dive deeper into the conversation, be sure and visit our blog at beyondawakeningseries.com/blog. And you can join, you know, please join our Facebook group at beyondawakeningseries.com/Facebook, where you can discuss any of the topics we talked about today. And you can find both forums just by clicking the link in the email we sent you earlier today. You're invited to post your comments about the dialogue we've just been having, and also your suggestions and questions for Sunday's dialogue with Brother David. And if any of you or any one of you might be interested in, anyone you know might be interested in this series, please forward them one of the emails or invite them to register at beyondawakeningseries.com. If you'd like to learn more about my work, please visit integralspiritualpractice.com. And I want to thank some of the sponsors who've made all this possible, especially the Sedona Method. Have you heard about the new movie called Letting Go? It will entertain and delight you and guide you into uncovering and living the truth of who you are. It's designed to support the worldwide awakening to truth that's already sweeping the planet. If you're already exploring the non-dual path, then you'll find its insights enlightening and refreshing. It also gives you powerful tools to use to introduce non-duality to those around you. Letting go will give you practical tools you can use every day to let go of the anxiety, anger, frustration, and limiting emotions that prevent you from recognizing your true nature and that cause you to re-identify with the dream. As you watch this movie, it will make you laugh and cry as it deepens your own understanding and openness to your own intuitive knowledge. To order the film, visit lettinggo.tv/movie-DVD. That's lettinggo.tv/movie-DVD. And Tools for Wellness. For over 22 years, my friends at Tools for Wellness have been leaders in offering leading-edge products for self-awareness, consciousness exploration, behavior modification, meditation, learning, memory, sleep, dreaming, sound therapy, stress and relaxation, noise reduction, EMF protection, and a whole lot more. They're a reliable company, knowledgeable, and prompt, and I encourage you to check out their website at toolsforwellness.com. Also, many of you have inquired about the music that we play while you're on hold before the dialogue begins. This is music by Ray Lynch, an old friend, and I think beautiful composer. He has a number of wonderful albums available at raylynch.com. That's Ray Lynch, RayLynch.com. And please remember to tune in on Sunday, October 31st, in just 3 days. We'll be talking at an early broadcast time, 11 a.m. Pacific time, which is 7 p.m. European time, with Brother David Stendhal Rost, the deeply wise and wonderful Christian mystic and pioneer of interreligious dialogue and of an integral panentheist Christianity. He'll join us live from Vienna, Austria, on Great Fullness, an Open Heart and Cultural Transformation. And when Brother David speaks to you, he really enters into your heart and mind in a profound and true way, and something happens, and you know it. When I got to know him during the early gatherings of the Integral Spiritual Center, I really fell in love with him. In all our encounters and conversations, I found that he was always creating the climate in which his profound ideas and gentle teachings on gratefulness could really be deeply received by everyone without fear and then explored in the tender regions of the heart. He does much more than speak about spiritual life. He really transmits it with the authority of the monk who is living it. For him, there hardly seems to be a distinction between teaching, preaching, praying, and meditating. And I'm just really delighted that I'll be able to share share this wonderful man with you. So it's on a holiday, a kind of holy and profane one, Halloween, All Hallows Eve, and it'll be early in the day before we have to go out and be spooks at 11 a.m. California time. And then next Thursday at our regular time, I'll be speaking with Robert Augustus Masters and Diane Bardwell Masters on transformation through intimacy. So thank you for hanging in there, and let's open up the phone line so that we can all hear each other's voices, or at least those of us who called in by phone, and say goodbye. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.
Thank
goodbye.
You for joining
Bye.
Us.
Bye.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone. Lots of love.
Thank you, Diane.
Aloha.
Thank you, Diane. Thank you, Terry.
All right. Thank you, guys. Goodbye. Bye. All right. Thank you.